See, my mule don't like people laughing. It's the crazy idea you're laughing at him. Now, if you apologize, like I know you're going to, I might convince him that you really didn't mean it.
You're listening to Benji's Retrospective of 2011. Find us at malconbenji.blogspot.com.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Benji's review of the year for 2011. As I did last year in 2010, what I'm going to do here is, sadly without Malk, who couldn't be here at the middle of the night on the 30th of the 12th, what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be talking about the films that I have seen in 2011. Just the films that came out in 2011, that were released in the UK in 2011, that I saw in 2011. I'll not be talking about films from different years. For example, I saw 12 Angry Men for the first time this year, but I'm not going to be talking about it. It's just films released in the UK in 2011. I'll be working in chronological order, and it won't be a full review. It will just be a couple of minutes for each film, maybe less if I've got less to say about it, maybe more. And as always, once you finish listening to the podcast, if you've got anything you'd like to say, anything you'd like to add, anything you'd like to argue with, please feel free to email in at churchofben@googlemail.com or on the blog at malconbenji.blogspot.com. As I say, I am without Malk today, but I still consider this part of Malcolm Benji's double bill. Without further ado, without further preamble, here we go. The first film I saw in 2011 was the excellent Danny Boyle true life drama 127 Hours. 127 Hours is the tale of a nutcase who basically went spelunking in Arizona or Utah. I'm just going to try and find his name here. I should have prepared this earlier, shouldn't I? So it's the true life story of Aaron Ralston, who was a sort of an adventure seeker. He was in Utah and he got his hand caught under a rather large boulder and was stuck for 127 hours before finally using his blunt tiny penknife to lop off his own hand and then scramble to safety. It's an amazing film. It's absolutely fantastic how both through the skill of Danny Boyle and James Franco, who plays Ralston, you get this real cinematic experience. It couldn't be done on TV. It couldn't be done as a stage play because it's the way that Boyle uses the camera. It's the way that he edits it together. It's the way that James Franco kind of, how Ralston through James Franco sort of escapes into his own mind to deal with this isolation, with his knowledge of his upcoming death. There's you know, bits where, like, he's had to pee in his water bottle and drink his own pee, and the camera goes inside the water bottle as the pee gets sucked up, and it's horrific. And then when Ralston's cutting his own hand off, and he sort of hits a nerve, and then the music, or then the sound effects, and the colours, and the way the camera shakes, it really recreates this idea that he's just, you know, literally slicing through a nerve in his arm. It's really visceral, very, very effective. And James Franco, he did a wonderful, wonderful job of capturing that, of basically carrying an entire film on his own shoulders. Great start to the year, really, really good film. Next film up is The King's Speech. Directed by Tom Hooper, starring Colin Firth, Geoffrey Rush, Helena Bonham Carter, and a whole bunch of others. It's the true life story of George the VII, who was forced into becoming the King of England after his brother's abdication. George himself sorry, George the Sixth, not George the Seventh. George himself had a speech impediment, and with the upcoming war and Hitler being such a phenomenal orator, George had to really sort of overcome his stammering, overcome his stutter, to become the figurehead that the British people needed, or at least that's the story. Personally, I'm not sure, from studying history, from talking to the older generations, how much that's true, whether or not George the Sixth really did have to be the sort of the figurehead of Britain. But that's the story that the film puts across. Colin Firth, very good as George the Sixth. I don't think it's a career best performance from him, even though he won the Oscar for it. But he is very, very good. Personally, I think Geoffrey Rush's Lionel Logue is better. I think Geoffrey Rush is a phenomenal actor. There's nothing he can't seem to turn his hand to. And he's really, really good as Lionel Logue, the Australian speech therapist who helps the king overcome his stammer. He really sort of pulls out the humour in the character, as well as the sort of the humility of him. He never announces himself as a doctor. He's just an actor who knows how to overcome speech impediments through acting techniques. Helena Bonham Carter is unlike her work for her husband Tim Burton, is very, very good, and you can see why she still gets cast in films that her husband's not directing, because she actually is quite a good actress. She plays the Queen, the late Queen Mother, as most of us knew her for the past 50 odd years. She plays the Queen Mother very, very well. Lots of humanity. She's very sort of upper class, but also very, very human. And she provides a lot of support, both in terms of the narrative and in terms of providing character support as the Queen Mother, as Elizabeth. Next up is The Green Hornet, directed by Michel Gondry, who is a really sort of visual filmmaker, a very interesting arty filmmaker, based on the old TV series about the masked vigilante. Seth Rogen plays the sort of rich playboy who dresses as an insect and fights crimes and dresses as an insect. He dresses in a sharp suit and calls himself the Hornet. Jay Chou, who is I believe a Korean pop star, plays Kato, the part made famous by Bruce Lee, and the part which made Bruce Lee famous. Cameron Diaz is the love interest slash reporter, and Christoph Waltz of Inglourious Basterds fame is the villain. Now, this film got quite a panning critically when it came out, and I didn't think it was that bad. It's certainly not a classic. It doesn't hold a candle to the sort of the really good superhero films that came out later in the year, but it's certainly better than its green competitor, The Green Lantern, which we'll get to later. It's a decent film. The interplay between Seth Rogen and Jay Chou is quite good. It's a bit sort of cliched, the way they sort of fall out and then get back together, and the narrative's not exactly special. The fight scenes are pretty good. There's a good few bits where Michel Gondry's inventive streak really comes out. Kato kicks a guy over the hood of a car and it sort of stretches back into the distance, like a whole house of mirrors, and it's really interesting to watch the fight scenes there. I wish there was more of that in there. But that's all very impressive. Cameron Diaz is really dull in it. She doesn't do much at all. I start to worry for her that she's sort of, after doing something about Mary, 10 plus years ago, she's really just spent. She's not nearly what she used to be. And unfortunately, Christoph Waltz has suffered from sort of the Euro Hollywood syndrome, which Noomi Rapace has also suffered from. We'll get to that later on. That he was absolutely superb in Inglourious Basterds, which is a very director-driven property, and then he's been cast in this Hollywood remake of a TV series, and he's been completely sort of Hollywoodized. He's just playing, admittedly he's playing it very well, but he's playing a very dull sort of villain character. He's not living up to the promise that he showed in Inglourious Basterds. I hope when we see him in the next Tarantino film, he's really sort of upped his game, because he wasn't good in Green Hornet. He wasn't bad by any standards, but he was just very, very samey. He could have been played by anyone. On to the next film, Black Swan by Darren Aronofsky. Now, this again is the opposite. This got critically absolutely lauded when it came out. People loved it, won a lot of Oscars. I really wasn't that impressed. Darren Aronofsky's always, I've always had a very odd reaction to his films. I loved Pi. When it gives his first film, which is about a mathematician who works out the sort of formula for God, and that was an amazing film, very, very well written, very well directed, low budget, black and white. Then he went on to do Requiem for a Dream, which I thought was massively overrated. People seem to think it really touches them on a personal level, and it just didn't for me at all. He's got very inventive visual sort of styles, but I don't think he really sort of can access a personal level in his films. But that's just my opinion of Darren Aronofsky. Natalie Portman is okay, but a bit melodramatic. Mila Kunis is quite good. Vincent Cassell's boring. He's just boring. I didn't see Marine Killer Instinct, or Mesrine Killer Instinct, however you pronounce it. But apparently he's phenomenal in that. But he didn't really show us that in this. He's better than Christoph Waltz in Green Hornet. He's not suffering from sort of the Euro Hollywood syndrome. But he's just, I didn't like his character. I didn't really respond to it. The whole film is very self-indulgent. You know, it's about a middle-class ballerina who, oh, I want to be the lead ballerina. Well, you know, so what? You're very pretty, you're a good dancer, live with it. You know, there's worse things people can be. On to the next film. The Fighter by David O. Russell of Three Kings fame. Again, teaming back up with Mark Wahlberg and Christian Bale. The Fighter was kind of a Rocky clone. It suffered a little bit from Rockyitis, trying to break away from the working class boxer, trying to, you know, achieve what he hitherto had not been able to achieve. Adding the sort of the dynamic of Christian Bale as his drug addicted brother. Bale is really, really good in it. Mark Wahlberg's really, really good in it. I think Mark Wahlberg can be a very, very good actor when he's got a good director, and he's worked with David O. Russell a few times with the I Heart Huckabees and Three Kings, and he's actually very good in this film. He plays the sort of the solid rock to Christian Bale's sort of flighty drug addict, and the two of them have a great chemistry together. It works very, very well having one very sensible, down-to-earth guy and one very sort of manic sort of kind of guy. They're brothers, and they fight, and then they come together and they fight again, and it's very, very interesting. It's a very good dynamic the two of them have got. And I think that lifts it apart from the rest of the Rocky clones that are out there. It's a film worth seeing for the performances. I don't know if it's going to be a classic, but it's a decent film. It's better than it should be, given it's another boxing film. Never Let Me Go is the next film, directed by Mark Romanek, written by Alex Garland, who is one of Danny Boyle's frequent collaborators. It's based on a Japanese novel set in England in an alternative reality where they have perfected, I better give you a spoiler warning here, if you haven't seen these films, don't be spoiled by them. I'll try not to spoil them anyway. Where cloning has been perfected, and the main characters played by Kerry Mulligan, Keira Knightley and Andrew Garfield are clones who are being grown for their organs, basically, so that their original copies can have the organs when they pack in. It's a very, very, very low-key sci-fi film, absolutely beautifully made. It's not sci-fi in any sort of traditional Hollywood sense of the word, but it's sci-fi in the truest sense of the word. It takes a scientific, fictional element, and it uses that to explore themes and issues which are important to sort of the human condition. In this case, it's mortality, it's our place in the world, it's hope, it's struggling for those few extra years. It's not like The Island, where we have a car chase and explosions and all fancy kind of stuff. These guys have no real desire to run away. They're kind of pathetic in that sense. They just want a few extra years together, and it's heartbreaking. When Keira Knightley seduces Andrew Garfield's character and Carey Mulligan's in love with him, it creates a love triangle, and you think, you know, with only a few years left, it really is heartbreaking. Beautifully acted, beautifully shot. A really, really, really good film. Well worth seeing for any serious sci-fi fan out there. Next up, we move to one of the year's real sort of big hitters, True Grit. The Coen brothers take on the classic novel, which had been made once before with John Wayne as Rooster Cogburn, famously. They've gone to great lengths, really, in publicity to sort of separate themselves, to distance themselves from the original. From the original film, I should say. I shouldn't really say that, should I? From the previous adaptation of the novel, the Charles Portis novel. It's not that different. How can it be? You know, it's about a one-eyed alcoholic fat man who is a U.S. Marshal. It is very, very different from the John Wayne version in many ways, and very similar, as it has to be, being based on the same book. Jeff Bridges is absolutely phenomenal as Rooster Cogburn. It's one of his best roles, in my opinion, since The Big Lebowski. He has so much fun with it. He's just this grizzled, stinking, drunken hero. And the way he speaks and what he says is fantastic. It's so entertaining and so well realised. You believe that he is a lawman from this lawless West. Matt Damon's great in his role. Matt Damon is one of my favourite sort of younger actors. I think he's over 40 now, but he's definitely he definitely sort of matches up to Jeff Bridges. You know, the two of them work very well together, and then adding in the third in the troika of stars in this film, Hayley Steinfeld, in one of her first movie roles. She plays the young Mattie Ross, who is, again, she's brilliant. She's a very, very natural young actress. She really gets the comedy in it. She really sort of puts across this character very, very well, and the three of them work fantastically together. You've got Josh Brolin and Barry Pepper as the bad guys, and they're both fantastic as well. Barry Pepper's very underrated, in my opinion, a very underrated actor. He should be in more than he is. But the sort of the fight scenes and the action sequences, while not quite as expansive as some modern westerns, they're handled very, very well. The sort of the iconic image of Rooster Cogburn riding across a plain with his horse straps in his mouth and a gun in each hand, just it looks fantastic in the film. It really does. They get those moments, as brief as they are, they get them down pat. It makes for a fantastic film, makes for a great, great climax to a very, very good film. Moving on then, Paul, written by Nick Frost and Simon Pegg, starring Nick Frost and Simon Pegg, is a comedy sci-fi sort of road trip movie about two comic book geeks who find an alien out in the middle of Nevada and have to help him get to his spaceship. It's kind of E.T. meets Cheech and Chong. It's directed by Greg Mottola, who's handled a few Hollywood comedies before. It's a fine film. It's a good film. It's not nearly as good as Hot Fuzz and Shaun of the Dead, and it makes you long for the third part of the Three Flavors trilogy. Which hopefully is coming out this year, or at least starting development this year. It's good, but it's watered down. It's not as visceral. It's not it pulls its punches more than Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz, and that's because it's not Edgar Wright directing it and writing it with them. It's not a British production company. It's Universal who've put the money behind it, and it's an American production for an American audience. I don't know whether that is the case or whether Nick Frost and Simon Pegg just have a different modus operandi than they do when they're working with Edgar Wright, but it just seems like a tamer film than it should have been. More gross out gags and less gags about the genre or about, you know, what it's meant to be making fun of. There's a religious sort of element in the film, and it seems to get away scot-free. It's like, oh, don't worry, you know, we're talking about religion, but this guy's a nutcase as well, so it's not. And it kind of dilutes the impact of the film. It's still very funny, but not as funny or as good as it should have been. And it suffers from one of the worst, and I blame Simon Pegg and Nick Frost for this, it suffers from one of the worst references and in-jokes towards the end of the film, It's just so obvious. Better needs doing next time, please, guys. Okay, next up we have The Adjustment Bureau, directed by George Nolfi, based on a short story by Philip K. Dick, starring Matt Damon, Emily Blunt and Terrence Stamp. And this is the story of a US senator who basically tries to win back a girl he falls in love with and is stopped by the agents of what we are led to believe is God or some sci-fi version of God. I think Philip K. Dick was very much into the idea that God was some kind of alien intelligence beyond our universe, and the film kind of waters that down to turn it into what could be a bureaucratic god. But it doesn't really matter. The important thing is that it looks at the idea of fate and destiny, not from a particularly philosophical standpoint, but from a romantic standpoint, where Matt Damon will fight destiny regardless of what it costs, and eventually the bad guys relent, you know, okay, fine, yeah, we'll let you be together, blah, 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 blah. It's a very good film while they're on the run. It's only afterwards that you start thinking that the narrative was a bit weak and should have been stronger. The original short story it's based on is a very, very sexist work, very, very slight, and like a lot of Philip K. Dick's work, provides brilliant ideas with lots and lots of room for change. And I think they have changed it, but they've changed it into something which is a little bit tame, a little bit Hollywood, and doesn't really look at what the Adjustment Bureau... what God interfering with our lives could mean in that sense. So it's a good film. It's a decent chase film. Matt Damon's very good. Emily Blunt I liked, but I didn't like a lot of the script that she had. It's like really just kooky for the sake of kooky sometimes. Terrence Stamp is very sort of intense and kind of intimidating as the leader of the Adjustment Bureau, or at least the fixer of the Adjustment Bureau. But he's very, very good. He's kind of a villain, kind of a good guy, very ambiguous character, played very, very well. So good performances, some great sort of sequences, chase sequences, lovely mise-en-scene with the costumes, the Adjustment Bureau, but all in all, a weaker, sort of more tepid film than I'd have hoped for based on a Philip K. Dick story. Next up is Rango, which is Gore Verbinski's anthropomorphic animal western, starring Johnny Depp, Isla Fisher, Bill Nighy, and a host of other very famous voices. Written, interestingly, by John Logan, who wrote Gladiator. It's a mixed bag. There's a lot of really, really good stuff in Rango. I think Johnny Depp is almost one of his best roles. I'm not a huge Johnny Depp fan. I think he's good, but I think he's massively overrated. My favourite film that he's done is Ed Wood, and I think this kind of fits into the mould of kind of a Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which is also a very, very good film, very good performance from him. He's not quite as manic as he is in that. It's kind of the Fear and Loathing kind of voice with an Ed Wood kind of heroic sort of thrust. He plays a chameleon. It's very, very good. I like the idea of he's coming into town. He's kind of a theatre geek chameleon who plays different parts in his cage. And when he gets lost out of the car, he walks into town and becomes Rango, this sort of cowboy chameleon. And he gets into all kinds of scrapes. And there's a big sort of Chinatown-esque water swindle that he overcomes. It's stylish. It's funny. It's not the best animated film of all time. It's not the best animated film of the year. Because, of course, there's a Studio Ghibli coming up. But it is very good. Gore Verbinski proving that, you know, he's not that bad. Pirates 1, The Ring, and now this. He's made some good films. He's worth following, just not if he's been forced by Disney to make evil films. Next film on the list, Battle Los Angeles. Jonathan Liebsman is the director, Chris Berellini is the writer, and it stars Aaron Eckhart and Michelle Rodriguez, who are two actors who really haven't yet hit their stride as far as being the stars of things go. It's a very well shot, very thinly written film. It's basically all the action scenes taken from what could be a better film out there. that's really all I've got to say about it. It's got, you don't really care about the characters, you don't really get to know anything about the aliens, which isn't in itself a bad thing. You know, mystery is a fine narrative device, but you don't find anything out, and you don't really care. So it kind of falls down on that front. As I say, a lot of the action scenes are very good, but it's sapped of all drama by having thin characters and a thin narrative. You're best off going to see Independence Day again or something, or Steven Spielberg's War of the Worlds if you want a really good alien invasion film that you care about. This unfortunately isn't it. Next up, Submarine, Richard Ayoade's film directorial debut, starring Noah Taylor, Paddy Considine and Yasmin Page, is a really nice, quirky little independent film. I say independent films, made by Film 4, so for British standards it's not independent. It's very, very well written, it's very, very well acted, it's quirky, but rather than being Zooey Deschanel quirky, as in quirky for its own sake, it's kind of ironic quirky. It's kind of quirky, but the quirky supports the comedy rather than replaces the comedy. It's really sort of difficult to talk about, being as it is a British film. It doesn't really follow the traditional narrative threads that we all sort of know and understand and enjoy. It's much more, and also it's based on a book, it's much more sort of nebulous than that. It's well worth a watch, though. Richard Ayoade is Moss from The IT Crowd, and Dean Lerner from Garth Marenghi's Dark Place. And the character that he plays in those films kind of are him, and his voice comes through in this film very much. So if you like his characters in those programs, you'll like Submarine. It's a good film, well worth watching. Next up is Limitless, with Bradley Cooper and Robert De Niro, directed by the fabulously named Neil Berger. It's a film about a guy who is given a drug which helps unlock the potential of his mind. He becomes an expert gambler, an expert investment banker. He's this sort of memory genius who can read characters' faces and manipulate them. He can fight better because he can guess what's coming next. He can sort of interpret what his opponent's going to do next. And then he goes through this film, and it becomes kind of a bit of a heist movie, kind of an intrigue movie. It's not bad, it's certainly not good, it's not the kind of film that you'd remember for very long afterwards. Robert De Niro phones in a performance, he's not bad, but it's not great. Bradley Cooper, fine leading man, but again, he needs a better vehicle than this. So it's an alright film, Limitless, but nothing special. Next up is The Eagle, Kevin MacDonald's Roman film about a Roman and a Celtic slave who go to try and find the standard of the Eagle of the Ninth, which was lost by Channing Tatum's father. It's actually a very similar narrative thread to Centurion from last year, but it's kind of more of a Hollywood film. It's more of a buddy, not a buddy comedy, a sort of like a buddy road movie. Two guys who don't get on fight a common enemy, get together, make friends, and it ends very much on a kind of a, and they walked off together into the sequel kind of vibe. The fight scenes are quite well done. Kevin MacDonald obviously knows what he's doing with that kind of action sequence. The script is all right. It's a very I wouldn't call it an average film. It's slightly better than average. Certainly it looks better than average. It's not a classic, but it feels like it could have been. It feels like it could have been this decade's Gladiator, and they just kind of didn't really do enough with it. It didn't say enough about invasion and occupation. It didn't say enough about who the Picts were, who the Celts were. It didn't sort of go into the character enough. It's more of a an adventure. It could have been an episode of a TV series about these two sort of Roman cops who go and solve Celtic crimes. It's that kind of thing. It doesn't feel like its own thing, like a stamp on the cinematic world. It feels more like a comma. It's decent. It's worth a watch, but it's not a classic. Okay, next up, Source Code, Duncan Jones's sophomore effort, his second film. Written by Ben Ripley, starring Jake Gyllenhaal and Michelle Monaghan. Jake Gyllenhaal actually got Duncan Jones involved in this film. It's not Duncan Jones's passion project. I'm still waiting to see Mute, his follow-up to Moon, which is set in the same universe as Moon, but on Earth. It's kind of like a Blade Runner set in Germany with this mute hero. I want to see that very, very much, but that's not happening at the moment. Instead, he's making a movie director for hire films like Source Code. Source Code, again, very sort of Philip K. Dick style science going on here. It's about a guy who can relive the same 8 minutes again as somebody else, kind of like a Quantum Leap effect. And in fact, the guy that played Sam in Quantum Leap is Jake Gyllenhaal's father via voiceover. A nice little nod there to Quantum Leap. It's a good film, Source Code. It's good in all the right places. It's exciting. It's not as good as Moon. It's not a patch on Moon, which is Duncan Jones's first film, which I loved. But it is a very good Hollywood film. It's a very good Hollywood sci-fi film. It's smarter than your standard Hollywood film. Jake Gyllenhaal, if anyone knows me, I hated Donnie Darko. And Jake Gyllenhaal's only gone to impress me more and more and more since Donnie Darko. I like Michelle Monaghan, she's fine. It's a decent film with a nice twist. Not a classic, again, I don't think. But definitely showing that Duncan Jones is a man to watch. Duncan Jones, you know, if as long as he keeps doing sci-fi, will be my favourite director of all time within a few films, probably. Apparently he's giving up sci-fi for a while, which I think is a bad idea. Not that he should do only sci-fi, but Duncan Jones, if you're listening, don't limit yourself. Keep doing sci-fi. Next up is Zack Snyder's Sucker Punch. Which is kind of the female version of 300 in that it's a very stylized, hyper-violent, wet dream of a film. 300 was very much kind of eye candy for the ladies with violence for the blokes. This is very much kind of faux empowerment for the ladies. I say faux empowerment, and sort of fighting for the blokes. Emily Browning plays Baby Doll and leads a group of girls who are in a mental institute, and they enter one level of sort of illusion where they are working in a bordello against the pimp, and then it goes into a further level of illusion where they become these warrior women in these very skimpy sort of fetishistic costumes and weapons and guns and swords and all sorts. And Emily Browning is sort of like a manga girl with these sort of stockings and short skirts and pigtails, hacking and slashing samurai robot creatures up into bits. I wanted to dislike it more, but I couldn't. Again, it's not the kind of film that I would recommend necessarily. But if you're not easily offended and you want sort of a film that's the equivalent of a meringue nest, just a light, fluffy, kind of not very deep sort of confection, then Sucker Punch is the way to go. The action sequences are very well done. If you like 300, you should like this. If you like 300 and you like Alice in Wonderland, you'll definitely like this. It's kind of Alice in Wonderland, but stripped down to one level and then run through the 300 aesthetic machine. It's not as bad as I thought it should be. If that makes sense. So it's worth a watch, but don't be offended. Don't blame me if you are offended. Ironically, there were a handful of animated prequels that came out to sort of publicise the film, and they go into so much more depth in terms of the narrative of the fantasy sequences. It's a shame the guys that wrote those couldn't have rewritten Zack Snyder's scripts and given it a bit more bite. And then maybe it would have been a much better film. It's worth checking those out on iTunes or trying to find them online. That's the Sucker Punch animated shorts. Yeah. Okay, next film up is one of the big ones of the year. Thor, Marvel's movie based on the comic book of the same name, loosely based on the Norse mythology the Norse god of the same name, directed oddly by Kenneth Branagh, who you wouldn't expect to do such a sort of a commercial comic book film, but he really brings an artistic bent to it. Chris Hemsworth plays Thor. He's not necessarily a great actor. He's much better in his brief role in Star Trek than he is in Thor. He can't really do the heightened, angry, sort of melodramatic theatrical stuff, certainly when he's placed against Anthony Hopkins. It reminds me of when Brad Pitt went off against Peter O'Toole in Troy. It just showed up his limitations, Brad Pitt's limitations as an actor. And this is the same when Anthony Hopkins thesps. He just shows up how you know, sort of limited Chris Hemsworth is. He's not bad, but he's not there. He's not good. Natalie Portman is the love interest. She's okay, but a little bit wasted. Tom Hiddleston as Loki, Thor's brother, is very, very good. He's the villain in the upcoming Avengers film, which I'm very much looking forward to. Thor is it's a decent film. It's a good film. The direction is much better, I think, than the film around it. The story's kind of cliched, and the script is kind of okay, and a lot of the character relationships are very sort of cliched and what you'd expect. Whereas the direction really gives it sort of verve and pomp, and the costumes look amazing and the sets look fantastic. Whether you're in Asgard and it's all sort of big and brass and sort of Wagnerian, or whether it's on Earth and it's very sort of down-to-earth working-class Americans, it looks fantastic. It looks brilliant. The action sequences are quite good. The fights are all right, but not. I don't know. They're not. I'm still waiting for a superhero film to have a fight scene that gets me sort of jumping up for joy. Ridley Scott did it in Gladiator. Richard Marquand did it in Return of the Jedi. You know, there's fight sequences in history which are both brutal, physical, and also dramatic. And Thor doesn't quite have them on that level. But they're all right. They're all right. I'd say it's a very solid 4 out of 5 movie. If I were going to give it a 4 out of 5, you know, out of 5 rating. Okay, on to the next film is Bridesmaids, written by and starring Kristen Wiig, the female lead in Paul. This is sort of like a guy's gross out comedy, but written by girls for girls. It's very, very funny. It's very, very well acted. It got great reviews when it came out, and rightly so. It does fall flat in a few places, like a lot of blokes' gross-out comedies do, but in far fewer places than films of this genre generally tend to do. It's very, very well written. Kristen Wiig is very, very charismatic. It's a very, very movie. It's possibly my favourite comedy of the year. I'd have to sort of put them all together and really think about that. It's certainly one of the better comedies of the year, up there with Submarine and films to come later on the list. It's good. It's a good film. It's not outstanding. It's not doesn't change the formula, but what it does very, very well in that genre of lowbrow comedy. It's one of the best examples of the year, indeed of the past 10 years. Next up is Takashi Miike's 13 Assassins, Jidaigeki, which is a Japanese period drama. It's kind of got a vibe of Seven Samurai about it, although obviously it's 13 assassins, not necessarily samurai, the 13 Ronin masterless samurai who become assassins to kill this sort of tyrannical lord. It's a really, really good film of the genre, if you like the genre. It's difficult to follow sometimes because it assumes a prior knowledge of the honor system of Bushido that samurai follow, and how that sometimes, you know, to true samurai is more important than life and death. The fight scenes, this is the fight film of the year. Takashi Miike's famous for his gore and his blood and his fight, and he reins it in a little bit here. It's not needlessly gory, but it doesn't pull any punches. The fights are phenomenal. The swordplay is very, very good. The story is interesting. The story is good enough. it's a bit sort of go here, do this, we've got this situation, let's go on a suicide mission to kill this guy, and then they go in and get it done. It's the last sort of 45 minutes is one big fight scene set in this village, this sort of labyrinthine village. It's absolutely stunning. It really does bring to mind Seven Samurai, and while it's not as good as Seven Samurai, being as it is Seven Samurai, one of the finest examples of action cinema known to man, it does hold up well against it. It's kind of like a pretender to the throne of Seven Samurai. It's good. It's a good film. If you like your action films, you like them to have proper action and not sort of Michael Bayisms, which we'll get to in a bit. It's very, very good. You care about the characters. You care about each of the 13 guys. Some more than others, but you care about them. And as they get picked off, it really hits you. Okay, next up is Hannah. Directed by Joe Wright, starring Saoirse Ronan, Kate Blanchett and Eric Bana, about a young sort of genetically engineered girl who's been raised in the wilderness of Finland as a hunter and assassin, sent by her father to kill the woman who killed her mother. It's a good film. It's a very good film. It's a little bit off tonally sometimes. There's a sequence or a couple of sequences in the films where Hannah, who is this sort of young, innocent-looking killing machine, meets up with his family and they become kind of a comic relief-style family. And that kind of loses it a little bit. It's like, what film are you really trying to get me to watch? And then at the end it becomes very sort of odd with its imagery, very sort of fairy tale, you know, Brothers Grimm, Hans Christian Andersen-esque, which again is odd considering the very sci-fi-y kind of beginning that it had. It's kind of like Sucker Punch, in the sense that you've got this young girl who is the strong sort of heroic character out there fighting the men, or in this case, you know, Kate Blanchett and her men. That's where the differences really begin. That's where the similarities end and the differences begin. Hannah is a much more relatable film. I think Sucker Punch is visually sumptuous, whereas Hannah is a better made film. I think it is better than Sucker Punch, but Joe Wright, the director of Hannah, really had a go at Sucker Punch, saying it was sort of a male fantasy, which it kind of is, but then so's Hannah in a way. You know, it's written by and directed by a bloke, or by two blokes, and I don't think you can really have a film that is about female empowerment written and directed by blokes. It just seems to me to be, this is what the bloke's idea of female empowerment should be, and if it's female empowerment, I'd want to see a woman director or a woman writer doing the film. I'm not trying to sound, you know, politically correct when I say that. I just think that Joe Wright is doing what Sucker Punch has done, but on a much more politically correct level. It's still a bloke giving his idea of what female empowerment should be. So I think his criticisms fall flat there. Having said that, he's a better filmmaker, so he wins on that count. So yeah, Hannah, good film. It's a kind of Bondish action film with a bit more depth to it. Well worth a watch. Next up is Joe Cornish's feature debut, Attack the Block. Attack the Block basically is an alien invasion movie set in the suburbs of working class London. It's a very inventive setting for a very sort of traditional genre. Jodie Whittaker plays a nurse who is mugged by a bunch of chavs, and they then join forces once aliens start landing in and around this block, this housing block. It's after hearing an interview with Joe Cornish, it became apparent really how much filmmaking had gone into this film. He wanted to make the block look like the spaceship in Alien, or look like the cityscapes of Blade Runner. And I think in a lot of ways he succeeds. It becomes a comment on sci-fi as well as a commentary on the class of the time. You know, the fact that people aren't willing to help at first because they're chavs. There's a lot of comments where they say, "Oh yeah, people just judge us on what we look like," and then the nurse, played by Jodie Whittaker, goes on to say, "Yeah, well, the first time I met you, you mugged me." And it's nice there that we see both sides of the argument. It takes the time to sort of look at those different social issues in the midst of this alien invasion. The aliens themselves are quite inventive. They're so black you can't see them apart from their glowing teeth. They're kind of like the alien from Alien. They're animals, they're beasts. But they're also kind of new, and they're kind of scary. So it's a comedy, horror, sci-fi action film that is, it doesn't lend itself more to one genre than the other, but it sort of straddles all four quite well. Maybe it would have been a better film if it had gone more down one of the routes than the others, but I think Attack the Block stands up there with films like Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz as excellent examples of how the British can do Hollywood genres and do them well. Which takes us on to the next film, Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides. Disney's fourth Pirates of the Caribbean film, this time directed not by Gore Verbinski, but by Rob Marshall of Nine fame and Chicago fame, written by Terry Rossio and Ted Elliott, who wrote Shrek and the original Pirates films. This is starring Johnny Depp, Penelope Cruz, Geoffrey Rush, Ian McShane. This is the very disappointing film. Given that they'd finished part three, they'd had the feedback from part three, they knew where they needed to improve, they knew where they needed to go back to the formula of the original of Pirates of the Caribbean, Curse the Black Pearl, and give us a one-off pirate adventure with maybe one supernatural twist and a simplified, cut-down narrative that allowed Johnny Depp to be Johnny Depp, or Keith Richards, as the case may be, and allowed for a go-here-do-that three-part structure. You know, it doesn't need to be original, it doesn't need to be particularly inventive, it just needs to stick to what it is. And instead, we get a jumbled mess with multiple plot threads, characters that we don't care about, a villain who, though Ian McShane is a phenomenal actor, does not give a villain vibe. Geoffrey Rush in the first film felt dangerous. Bill Nighy in the second and third films felt very, very dangerous. Ian McShane doesn't. He doesn't do anything. He doesn't kind of punish anyone. He's kind of looks scary, and he's Blackbeard, for God's sake. But he's neutered. He's a neutered version of Blackbeard. He was probably cast because of his role in Deadwood, in which he plays a foul-mouthed villain. And if they let him swear more and be as villainous as he is there, he may have worked, but they don't. So, yeah, disappointments there. The Hangover Part 2 is our next film. So that's all I've got to say about Pirates. It's kind of... Part 2 and 3 rolled into one. Disappointing, very disappointing film. On to The Hangover Part 2. Another, unfortunately, very disappointing film. It's The Hangover Part 1, but this time it's in Bangkok. And that's it. There's more poo, there's more trannies, there's more sort of stuff going on. It's a case of bigger, but not necessarily better. The first Hangover I quite enjoyed. There's bits that I didn't like. I thought Mike Tyson sort of seemed out of place. His scene seemed out of place in The Hangover Part 1. But for the most part, it was an enjoyable romp. Hangover Part 2 does nothing to add to that formula. It just rehashes the same thing over again. It's an odd and nebulous thing. When do you follow formula and when do you veer from it? And Pirates fell flat by veering too far from it, and Hangover has done the same by has fallen flat by veering too close to it. Hopefully, if there is a Hangover 3, they will do something different. I don't know what they could do different. I personally don't think a Hangover 3 should happen. But if it does, then they need to do something different to make it worthwhile. Next up, we have X-Men First Class, and a return to form for the X-Men franchise. The best film since X-Men 2, possibly the third best of the franchise after X-Men's 1 and 2, leagues ahead of Wolverine, and better than the underrated, I think, X-Men 3, which is underrated but still pretty crap. X-Men First Class is a very capable film. Matthew Vaughn of Kick-Ass fame and former producer of Guy Ritchie films. He gives us his his X-Men film. He was originally slated to do X-Men 3 before he dropped out. So it's nice to see what he would finally have done with the X-Men films. It suffers a little bit from sequelitis. There's lots of characters. There's lots of stuff that, you know, doesn't really need explaining because we've kind of had the films that come before. It's good. It's a well-made film. The rhythm's right. The structure's right. Michael Ironside's in it as a random Navy captain for some reason. Genre stalwart Michael Ironside should have been a much bigger character than he was. I hope they bring him back as Mr. Sinister or something. X-Men First Class, it's a good film. Hopefully X-Men First Class 2 or X-Men Second Class, as it might be called, will be better. But if you ask me how, I'd need a long time to think about it. It is very, very good. Michael Fassbender is phenomenally good as Magneto. I really, really think he has got a lot of charisma. I think he could go very, very far. Sorry, that's my cat just playing with the microphone. I think he could go very, very far. I think he's made a really good start for himself this past couple of years, doing a combination of blockbusters and smaller, more quality dramas. I think he could go very, very far. Next up is the documentary Senna, directed by Asif Kapadia, based on the life and career of Ayrton Senna, who was one of the sort of legends of Formula One racing before his untimely death. It's actually a phenomenal film. One of the things that a lot of film critics have said is that it's a kind of film that you don't need to be interested in racing to enjoy. I hate Formula One racing with a passion, and I loved Senna. It's the story of the man, and he was a man you can really get behind. He was outstanding. He was an outsider who just was a good racer. He didn't get into the politics of it. There's a rivalry in the film. There was a rivalry in his life between a guy they called the Professor, a French driver. I forget his real name. And basically he would go for points, whereas Senna would race to win, and the rivalry between them really drives it forward. It's very, very good, very well put together, shot from thousands of hours of footage of Ayrton Senna as he started in sort of in Brazil and then got onto the world stage, and more cameras started following him. The footage gets better, but it's a very, very well put together film that tells a fantastic story about the guy, not just the sport. So well worth a watch there. Even if you don't like documentaries, even if you don't like racing, it's a film that is well worth watching. Next up, on the other end of the scale, we've got Kung Fu Panda 2, directed by Jennifer Yu Nelson, who, thanks to the success of Kung Fu Panda 2, has become the most profitable female director of all time, which is bizarre when you think about it. That Kung Fu Panda 2, good though it is just a sequel to a film that was just another film from the guys that made Shrek. I think Kung Fu Panda was a very, very good film. I think Jack Black, it's one of his best roles, along with School of Rock and, of course, High Fidelity. And Kung Fu Panda 2 is a very strong sequel, albeit just a sequel. It follows very familiar narrative strands. You know, it does what a sequel is meant to do. It does it very, very well, but it doesn't really give you anything new. If you didn't like Kung Fu Panda 1, you won't like Kung Fu Panda 2. And if you did like Kung Fu Panda 1, you'll like Kung Fu Panda 2 as much, if not a tiny bit more. Gary Oldman's great as the villain. He has a right amount of comedy and menace. The supporting cast are fine but underused. And Jack Black, once again, is very, very good. I like the fact that at the end of the first film, he becomes a Dragon Warrior. In this second film, he is still the Dragon Warrior. He's still a very good fighter. But they give him a different thing to work on, a different sort of skill almost, like in the sort of kung fu film genre. You need to find the inner peace, grasshopper, to do things. Anyway, he has that in this film. So the well done to the writers, of which there were many, for finding that reason for keeping the character develop developing after he'd already achieved in the first film. Great action sequences. There's a lot of animated, sort of certainly CG animation, that does bizarre things with the camera these days. Tintin is an example from this year that I'll be coming to later, that I wasn't overly keen on. But Kung Fu Panda 2 mostly avoids that. It's the camera doesn't seem like it's attached to a rocket sled. It doesn't seem like there's a guy with ADHD holding it. It kind of follows the characters when they fight. Sometimes it gets a bit too close and a bit too sort of inny and outy. But for most of the time, you see these animated characters doing Kung Fu, which is great. There we go. So on to the next film, which is Green Lantern. Directed by Martin Campbell, who reinvigorated Bond twice with GoldenEye and Casino Royale, and also Zorro with The Mask of Zorro. Martin Campbell should be a safe pair of hands. Unfortunately, Green Lantern is a real damp squib. Ryan Reynolds is underwhelming as the Green Lantern himself. Blake Lively is dull as the girlfriend. Peter Sarsgaard's alright, but really a bit insipid as the villain. Mark Strong as the mentor slash villain slash whatever he is just phoning it in, doing the Mark Strong performance. He's in sort of everything recently, and I think he's at very, very strong risk of wearing out his welcome if he doesn't start doing things differently, if he doesn't start alternating his characters. The film itself, it starts off with a very, very Star Wars-y kind of space opera Lensman opening, which crams in loads and loads of DC Comics lore before going on to this sort of fairly decent but very brief action sequence where the previous Green Lantern gets mortally wounded, ready for Ryan Reynolds to take over. And then we get this really dull origin story where he makes a big toy racing track to save someone's life. He creates a Gatling gun and a pair of swords in his training. He decides to leave because he can't hack it after a day. It's a very, very mixed film, very poorly written, overuse of CGI. I mean, how else could you do Green Lantern other than CGI? But maybe it should have been a CGI animated film, I don't know. But it's a very sort of wishy-washy, they're trying to do Thor, they're trying to do what Marvel are doing with Green Lantern, and create a franchise Kickstarter, and they haven't succeeded here. The writers, the director, the story, it's just too bleh. The villain is a cloud, which was one of the problems with Fantastic Four 2, It's poor. It's a poor, poor film with poor use of CGI. I mean, the Green Lantern doesn't really appeal to me as an idea anyway, but I went to the film quite excited. But no, it's not worth your time or money. If you really want some Green Lantern, just go and get a comic or something, or go and get one of the animated films. I'm sure they're much, much better than this dross. Next up is the documentary Life in a Day, sort of shepherded together by Kevin MacDonald and Ridley Scott. It's a documentary where people around the world sent in their footage based on their day, basically. And it's a very, very interesting film, some very, very beautiful parts of it. It ends on a bit of a weird note with this woman complaining, sort of a working-class American woman complaining about her life not being the way she wanted it to be, which, after you've seen what came before, the guy cycling the world to reunite Korea, there's a Japanese guy and his son who have a shrine to his, you know, the poor dead wife in the house. Some beautiful, beautiful moments. Then it ends on this really sort of whingy sort of American woman. That kind of bugged me a little bit, but for the most part, it's a stunning snapshot into the world we live in, and well worth a look just to get an idea of what the world is like beyond our comfort zones. Life in a Day, excellent film. Next up is Stakeland. Directed by Jim Mickle and written by Nick D'Amici, starring Nick D'Amici as this sort of Mad Max style badass vampire hunter. It's a vampire film in the same way that it kind of does the same thing as as the road, not quite the road, but almost like the Book of Eli. It takes this post-apocalyptic setting, in this case it's a vampire apocalypse, where the world has been overrun by vampires, and it turns it into a very grungy, gritty kind of road trippy, fighting for your life, living in burnt out cars, you know, badass hero that doesn't get a name, he's just called Mister. It's a very, very good film. It's a low budget film, and it looks low budget, but they really eke out every dollar. It's not a blockbuster by any standards, but it is well worth a look, especially for fans of the genre. If you're sick of your sparkly vampires, Redwood Cullens, this is an absolute antidote to that. It's just a really cool, badass vampire film. And yeah, there should be more films like this being made. To counteract the next film on our list, Transformers Dark of the Moon, the third in Michael Bay's Transformer trilogy, and I say nothing has improved. Very little has improved. It is better than the second one. It's better than Revenge of the Fallen, but not much. It's like saying that being stabbed through the kidney is better than being stabbed through the brain. It's yeah, that's better, but you don't want either, really, do you? Thin script, bad characters. Shia LaBeouf is just, he shouldn't be in films anymore. He had potential back in iRobot and Constantine, but he's bad. Even if he's not a bad actor, he's bad at picking jobs, and he shouldn't be doing this. He makes the character even more whingy and whiny. Rosie Huntington-Whiteley is a new love interest. She's not even an actress, she's barely even a person. Why is she in films now? Michael Bay, he's not a director, he's not a film director. He can't direct a film. He goes on about how good he is, blah, blah, blah. He wrote a letter to projectionists in cinemas around the world saying we're all in this together. No, we're not. You know, projectionists care about movies. You don't. He can't direct anything. He might make a decent cinematographer. He certainly made some very good Meatloaf music videos in the 90s. But he's not a film director, not by any stretch of the imagination. It's a poor film. It's overlong, it's flabby in its narrative, it's got improbable, illogical plot twists, when characters who you thought were good are bad, and who you thought were bad were good, and blah, 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 blah. It stops in the middle for this comedy sequence with John Malkovich. Ken Jeong's badly miscast. He does this sort of weird physical comedy, crawling all over Shia LaBeouf in a toilet cubicle while staring at him intensely, and it's one of the most off-putting things I've ever seen in my life. What could have been a fairly interesting, fairly intense dialogue scene between two people in a locked room becomes this ridiculous sequence that can't tell whether it's comedy or intrigue. It's a bad, bad film, and Michael Bay should be banned from making films. Next up is John Michael McDonagh's The Guard. John Michael McDonagh, his brother, made In Bruges a few years ago, which up until now is one of the finest sort of crime comedies that I've ever seen. And John Michael McDonagh adds to that with The Guard. I'm not sure whether I prefer The Guard to In Bruges. It did better in terms of box office. They both star Brendan Gleeson, and they're both very similar in tone, very darkly comic. So I can't tell which one I prefer, but The Guard is definitely a very, very strong contender for British Film of the Year. It's a very strong script. Brendan Gleeson's phenomenal as the main character. Don Cheadle's excellent as his sidekick. I think Don Cheadle's really the hero of the film, but we follow Brendan Gleeson's narrative. He's sort of the can't-be-arsed cop. In Galway. It's a phenomenal film, very, very strongly written, good action sequences, very, very interesting plot going on there. It's sort of like a fairly traditional crime drug plot, but with this can't-be-arsed police officer not helping the FBI guy who's come to sort it out. It's very, very good, very, very funny, very, very exciting. So, yeah, when it comes out on DVD, everyone who listens to this podcast should buy it, because it's very, very good. Next up, the opposite of The Guard, The Guard being a low-budget film, which turned out to be everything it should be, is a huge-budget film, which turned out in the end to be, in my opinion, and I can see that I'm maybe alone here, a rather disappointing end to a long saga. Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2. Same creative team as the previous bunch of films. David Yates directs, Steve Kloves writes. The cast all come back for one last hurrah. But unfortunately, it just doesn't cap the series off the way that I wanted it to. I'd have much rather seen one Harry Potter 7 film that cut out more than it did, but that felt more like a single film. I think one of the biggest problems I've got with it is that they left the fight out of Harry Potter 6 because they didn't want to draw attention from this one, the big battle. And the big battle in this just doesn't feel coherent. It doesn't feel like it's a climax. It doesn't feel like good versus evil like it should. It feels like a level in a computer game where you're hopping from platform to platform, and in the background you can see people fighting, but there's not really a connection there. The final moments between Voldemort and Harry, which should have been taken word for word from the book, instead they adapt it to be something more visual, and it just doesn't work. It looks great, but it just doesn't fulfill narratively, you know, how it's meant to be. In the book, there's a whole reason why Harry beats Voldemort, and it's all to do with the character, it's all to do with the hubris, it's to do with loyalties, it's to do with a lot of character stuff. And here it just looks like Harry beats him in a wand fight, and it's just good luck. And it takes away from seven previous films, seven narrative years of struggle, of fighting, of learning, of becoming a wizard. It takes away from all that, and it just makes it a bit of a damp squib. It's exciting enough, it's well shot enough, but it's just not a satisfying ending to the sequence. For those people who whinged on about half an hour of Return of the King endings, I'd much rather have half an hour of overlong endings than what we get here. Also, the epilogue looks weird. The makeup looks weird. They're all obviously teenagers who have been made up. It doesn't look good enough. Biggest film of the year it was, box office wise, and unfortunately, didn't really do it for me. Okay, next one is our Studio Ghibli entry for the year, directed by Hiromasa Yonebayashi, who is one of the sort of proteges Hayao Miyazaki, so the Walt Disney of Japan. This is Arrietty, based on Mary Norton's The Borrowers, starring in the English dub Saoirse Ronan and Mark Strong. It's a really, really beautiful film, like all the Studio Ghibli films are. It's that art style, the characters are drawn in that style. It's hand-drawn animation, which, you know, these guys are the best people in the world doing hand-drawn animation at the moment. It looks stunning. The world, it's just this really sort of normal Japanese house, and when we're on the human scale it looks like a really nice but normal house. When we're on the borrower scale it looks like some kind of giant mansion, and it's beautiful the way they make the mundane look extraordinary with the focus of where the camera is and how we see it through the character's eyes. There's mention made in a film magazine, an Empire film magazine, of how when they're drinking water it looks like big balls of jelly because they're so small, and it's that attention to detail which shines through. The script is good, it's not particularly amazing, but it's good. The book itself, you know, is a classic, and the script really just sort of like translates that to the screen. But it's the direction, it's the design, it's the Studio Ghibli-ness of it which really stands out. Even their worst films are worth watching, and this is far, far from one of their worst films. I go as far as to say it's my favourite non-Hayao Miyazaki Ghibli film. It's really, really good and well worth a watch. Another thing I really like about it is that it's kind of a post-apocalyptic tale, certainly for the borrowers. They think they may well be the last borrowers alive on Earth. And we see this apocalypse from such a different perspective. Normally it's Terminators and, you know, charred cars and exploded cities, but here we've just got this, you know, dilapidated doll's house or this sort of run-down basement, and it looks like the post-apocalypse, but not for people, not for humans, I should say, but for the borrowers. And that's a really, really interesting way to take it. And then when they leave at the end, it's almost this idea of you know, where are they going? You know, it's a case of, I'm not saying who's leaving or whether they survive or whatever. I'm not, hopefully not spoiling anything, but the ending gives it this really sort of ambiguous, hopeful and pessimistic exit, which is beautiful, absolutely beautiful. So yeah, Arrietty, stunning film. Should have been called The Borrowers, but never mind. It's well worth a watch. I can't recommend Studio Ghibli's back catalogue enough. They are just, you know, animated films, maybe mainly designed for kids, but there's so much in them for all audiences. They're brilliant. They're brilliant, brilliant films, and Arrietty is no exception. Okay, next up to a film which I don't think is as good as Arrietty, but it's certainly a film that I enjoyed just as much. It's a far more commercial, far more action-packed, far less thoughtful, but no worse for it, Captain America: The First Avenger. The last Marvel film before The Avengers comes out tells us the origin story of The First Avenger. It's directed by Joe Johnston, who is famous for doing The Wolfman, which is terrible, and Jumanji, which is alright, but also The Rocketeer, which is very, very good. And it's The Rocketeer that most closely resembles Captain America: The First Avenger, being as they are set in the same time period. And Joe Johnston gives you that sort of nostalgic World War II gung-ho action film sort of atmosphere, unlike anybody else. You know, your Spielbergs go for very epic, very human. You know, your other directors go for other aspects. Just mine went blank for a second, but Joe Johnston really goes for sort of action-packed and adventurous. And while, you know, any World War II survivor would tell you that is not perhaps an accurate tone historically, cinematically it really, really does work. Chris Evans plays Captain America, and he is he's absolutely fine. He's good. He's not great. He's no Robert Downey Jr., but neither is he a Chris Hemsworth. He's good. But he's been better in previous films. I loved him in Sunshine, loved him in Scott Pilgrim. Here, his charisma is toned down so that he fits more into the hero mould. And I think that that does him a disservice, but it does the film a service. So he becomes kind of a fairly, not banal, but a fairly uninteresting hero who is basically the costume. And it's the costume that we like to see. You know, we need to see his origin so we can care about him, and we do, but it's the costume and the shield that we pay to see. And that it's good when he comes out and does that, that he's not wisecracking all over the place, like Green Lantern. Hugo Weaving is fine as the villain. He plays a very good Red Skull. I think The Matrix has done him a massive disservice, because he played one of the best villains of the 90s in The Matrix, and since then, when he plays a villain, you know, they want him to be the villain, but he's not wasted as a Red Skull, but they don't do as interesting a bunch of things with him as they could. He does the Red Skull very, very well, but Hugo Weaving can do better. And then there's a whole host of other actors in there who do fine performances. It's a very adventurous film, very exciting film. The action sequences are good. It acts as kind of an extended prologue to The Avengers, whereas I'd like it more to be a standalone thing, you know, by itself. But it's good. It's very, very good. For a blockbuster, it's very, very good. Okay, next up we have Super 8, which is J.J. Abrams' love letter to the late 70s and early 80s of cinema. It's a very Spielbergian film, being as it is produced by Spielberg, and written as an homage to those sort of films, the Jaws, the E.T.s, the Close Encounters. It's got a very sort of vibe similar to those films. It's very well shot. I think the ending kind of falls flat a little bit. It becomes very sort of traditional in the ending. But the run-up to that is excellent. The kids in it are very, very good. Kyle Chandler as the father is excellent. There's not much more I can say about it. It's a very, very good film. Very, very worth watching. Maybe not, you know, a special film. J.J. Abrams, I think Star Trek is his best film so far. Even though Super 8 is a more personal film, Star Trek is his best film. He's not sort of an auteur, but as far as a blockbuster director goes, he is very, very good. He's definitely winning kudos with me. Next up, one of my votes for Blockbuster of the Year, if not Film of the Year, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, directed by Rupert Wyatt, starring James Franco, Frida Pinto and John Lithgow, amongst others. And hopefully this time he'll be nominated for an Oscar, Andy Serkis, proving he is the king of motion capture performance. And I'd like to underline the word performance in that phrase, because he does perform. He is an actor. He's not a guy in a suit just doing the motions. He is an actor. The emotions that he can portray with his facial expressions, his body language, his performance, are transcribed onto the CGI ape that he plays. But it's his acting. Just like Gollum, just like King Kong, he plays a phenomenal part here. And the film really is his, as good as the rest of the cast are. It's a second go at rebooting Planet of the Apes after Tim Burton's horribly misjudged sci-fi in 2001. And while I liked the setting of Tim Burton's one, the costumes and the visuals, the story was bobbins. And the acting wasn't very good either. Rise of the Planet of the Apes is the exact opposite. It's a very interesting sci-fi story set in modern-day San Francisco, so it looks like the real world. But you've got this idea here of what is humanity. You know, we've taken these creatures, we've made them intelligent, now we're treating them like animals again. You know, can we really expect them to take it? And you know, the answer is, of course, no. It's very well written, very well acted. The climax feels utterly justified. It feels earned. You know, very rarely is it that I will shed a tear over a piece of CGI, but in this case, you know, I did. You know, it's Weta Workshops are pioneering digital acting. And that's what I think it should be called, digital acting. You know, these people in these suits playing these apes are actors, and their acting is put on stage, on screen. It's very, very good. It's very well performed. It's not a complete story. You know, it's the origin story of the intelligent apes from the Planet of the Apes franchise. Hopefully, to then be followed up by a sequel. It's a great film, very, very good. Definitely one of the contenders for blockbuster of the year. Next up, we have Cowboys and Aliens, a real damp squib of a movie. Not really Jon Favreau's fault. The direction is fine. The script isn't. Script's dull, very, very dull. Uninteresting. Doesn't really do an awful lot. The title kind of sells itself as something. It's kind of a Snakes on a Plane title. You can't live up to something that in your face without really going for it, and they don't go for it. It tries to be a serious Western with aliens, and it just doesn't work. Daniel Craig's fine but not special. Harrison Ford's fine but not special. Olivia Wilde's fine but not special. The supporting cast, Paul Dano and a bunch of others, are all, you know, good. They all play their parts very well. It's just not that good of a film. It's a good idea that was just not that well made. Worth a watch if you can get it for free or cheap, but it's certainly no classic. I think Universal put a lot of money into this. They put a lot of advertising revenue into Cowboys and Aliens, hoping it would be their tentpole, and it turned out not to be. So that's a shame. They did have some very good films this year, Universal, but this was just not one of them. Okay, next film, Conan the Barbarian by Lionsgate, directed by Marcus Nispel, one of the most undeserving film directors of all time, based on the stories by Robert E. Howard, but changing just enough that they've managed to keep all the rubbish and get rid of all the good stuff. This is, really, it's a remake of the Arnie film. They go, oh yeah, we're going away from the Arnie film, back to the books. They're not going back to the books at all, because they've invented far, far too much to be going back to the books. Jason Momoa, so good in Game of Thrones, is really kind of cliched and poor in this film. He doesn't play a good Conan. Stephen Lang phones it in as the villain, so good as he is in Terra Nova, and fantastic in Avatar, he phones it in here. Rachel Nichols is just not a strong actress at all, and Rose McGowan is probably the best thing in the film. She's just not as good as she should be. I'd much rather see her as Red Sonja in a film of Red Sonja than I would in this dross. Instead of seeing Conan 3 King Conan with an aged Arnold Schwarzenegger, we get this reboot, which is poor. It's not as bad as Solomon Kane. It's not a patch as bad as Van Helsing, obviously. But it is a poor film. Shouldn't have been done. Waste of money. get the Wachowskis making Conan 3 with Oliver Stone and the guy that made Conan 1 with Arnie as Conan. That's my advice. Next up, another contender for Film of the Year is the very bizarre, slightly original, excellently executed Ghostbusters meets Blair Witch style Troll Hunter, directed by Andrew Ovredal, and written by and starring Norwegian comedian Otto Jespersen. It's a found footage film, sort of a Cloverfield style tale of a troll hunter, a guy who is hired by the government of Norway to go out into the wilds and kill any trolls who are veering out of their territories and preserve the ones that are in the territories. And it's absolutely amazing. It's so funny, while at the same time being utterly realistic. The trolls are both ridiculous creatures and terrifying creatures. It's a horror comedy par excellence. The cast are all fantastic. The style is brilliant. I love the idea of the Christianity in it. Trolls can smell Christians, so they hire a Muslim camwoman after their Christian one gets eaten. It's a really, really good film. Massively underrated, underseen in Britain. And you should go and get the DVD as soon as it comes out. It's a really, really good film. Next up we have Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, which is based on the John le Carré novel, directed by Thomas Alfredson, who directed Let the Right One In. We've got Gary Oldman, Colin Firth, Tom Hardy, Mark Strong, and a whole host of others in this very, very well written, very, very well directed spy thriller, which takes spying back to its roots. It's a spy thriller about spy versus spy, not gadget versus gadget. I love the recent Bonds, but this really is what spy films are about. It's Gary Oldman working out people's motivations, speaking to people, hearing people, listening to people. It's very, very well written, well directed. There's a tension to it that you just don't get in most other films. You know, I said this myself when it came out. Whereas a lot of spy films have a car chase, what this has is a look. And it's just as exciting as the car chase when Gary Oldman's eyes flick from one person to another. It's stunningly done. It's not a film to go and see with a person who has attention deficit disorder. It's slow, but it's not ponderous. It's slow and tense, like the turning of a screw. It's very, very well done, very, very tense, very intense, and masterfully directed. So yeah, for an old school spy thriller about people, you could do a lot worse than go see Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Next up, from Eli Craig, the man who gave us B-movie horrors in the past, the name of which I forget. I will come to it when it springs back into my mind. We have Tucker and Dale versus Evil, which is a film that stars Alan Tudyk and Tyler Labine as two rednecks who are confused, who are mistaken, sorry, for redneck killers by a bunch of beautiful college kids, when actually they're a pair of really sweet guys. And we follow the film from their point of view, as well as these students try and sort of escape them and end up killing themselves, and try and take revenge and end up killing themselves more, and making Tucker and Dale seem evil when they're actually just a pair of really nice guys. It's a lovely twist on the old backwoods Deliverance, you know, cabin fever style horror film. Very, very funny, and also, you know, really well acted. It's a brilliant comedy horror. Should have had more attention than it did. But again, it's hopefully one that will develop a cult following as time goes on. Very, very interesting film, very entertaining film, and Alan Tudyk and Tyler Labine are fantastic in it. Hopefully there'll be a Tucker and Dale versus series of films. Just hope they don't do it to death. Next up we have Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, directed by Troy Nixie, but produced and written by Guillermo del Toro. based on an idea that Guillermo del Toro had. It's a remake of a TV movie from the 70s about these weird little gnomes or fairies that live beneath the house and sort of go about doing horrible things. It's a sort of Del Toroian horror film. Basically, it's a dark fairy tale. Katie Holmes and Guy Pearce plus a little girl are in a home that's terrorized by these little creatures that eat teeth. It's a good film. It's a scary film. There's one bit that really sort of scared me. It's kind of cliche when you think back on it, but it was used effectively. It's again not a classic, but worth watching if you're a fan of horror films. It's kind of old school. It's not sort of gory. It's not a torture porn film, but it's an effective sort of creepy horror film. Next up. Is a horror film of a very, very different breed. It's the possibly the first realist horror film that I certainly can remember ever seeing. It's Contagion by Steven Soderbergh and Scott Z. Burns. Matt Damon, Kate Winslet, Jude Law, Gwyneth Paltrow and Lawrence Fishburne star in this tale of bird flu, basically, or swine flu. It's the wrong bat meets the wrong pig, creates a new strain of flu, and it ends up wiping out millions of people around the world. It's not like Outbreak, where it's a race against time. It's literally a case of let's solve this with science. It's brilliant. It's very, very affecting. It's very realistic. You know, it's a villain that A, you can't really fight in a traditional way. You have to fight him with science, the villain being the flu, of course. And it's a villain that may well pop his ugly head up tomorrow in real life. You know, it's not a villain, it's not Freddy Krueger, it's not aliens, it's not something that's unusual, it's something that may well happen. You know, it may well have already happened by the time you're listening to this. It's a very affecting sort of premise, and it makes for a great film, and Steven Soderbergh does very, very well with it. Jude Law plays sort of the human face of villainy as this sort of blogger who exploits people's fears to make money, and he plays it with a bit of a weird accent, but he plays it very well. It's perhaps his performance of the year, although we'll get to another film of his later on. So yeah, Contagion, if you like horror films or you like science films or you like sort of films about people trying to survive, it's a very, very good example of that genre. Very, very good film. Next up, The Adventures of Tintin, directed by Steven Spielberg, produced by Peter Jackson and written by Doctor Who's Steve Moffat, Hot Fuzz's Edgar Wright and Adam Joe's Joe Cornish. With a pedigree like that, you'd expect an absolute blinder of a film, and instead what we get is this kind of almost a damp squib, almost a sort of a real letdown. It purports itself to be halfway between Indiana Jones and the Famous Five, and it ends up just being this mess. Andy Serkis and Jamie Bell and Daniel Craig all, you know, do very well as the voice cast. The voice cast are phenomenal. But the script is kind of all over the place in terms of the plots and in terms of the story threads and in terms of what we're meant to be watching when and where and why. And some of the directorial decisions are phenomenal, like when Captain Haddock has a flashback and the sands become the sea and we've got all this pirate stuff going on. That's great. But then the main sort of set piece in the film is this single take trip down a hill as this town kind of gets washed away. And it's an example of what I was saying before. With Kung Fu Panda 2, the camera sort of does the right thing. With Tintin, because Spielberg's had the camera freed up with it being a CGI film, he kind of does too much with it. In Raiders of the Lost Ark, the camera was put there and the stunts happened. And it looked good because it was stunts and because the camera let you see it. In this, the camera kind of prevents you from seeing a lot of what's going on because it flashes and swashes around too much. And it's too much. You know, it's far be it from me to say what's good and bad directing when talking about Steven Spielberg, the legend, but it's just not among his best work, and it really should have been given the subject matter, given how close to his best work it is. So yeah, it's disappointing. I'm hoping when Peter Jackson does the sequel, he takes it down a notch and directs it like a live-action film. But whether he does or not, I don't know. So yeah, unfortunately, I wanted to like it more than I did. It was a bit of a letdown because of that. sloppy narrative and over enthusiastic cinematography. Next up is Tarsem Singh's Immortals, kind of Clash of the Titans by way of The Fall. The Fall is a very ill-seen Tarsem Singh film, his second film, in fact, this being his third, which uses almost no CGI. In fact, I'm pretty sure it uses no CGI to create this globe-trotting tale of these band of characters out to save a princess. And it's stunning, absolutely visually stunning. And Immortals uses a lot of CGI, but follows that same very, very beautiful aesthetic that Tarsem Singh has. He's a very, very good director here, taking on Greek mythology. He's getting it to look like a Renaissance painting, apparently, as it was his what he wanted to do with it. He wanted to take the Renaissance painting and turn it into an action film, and he's done that very well. Mickey Rourke is superb as the villain, as King Hyperion conquering the world. Odd costume, odd helmet, but he pulls it off. There's a brutal scene where he espouses his philosophy to a guy who's betrayed his people to Hyperion, and that just, you know, it makes you believe that he's a guy to be reckoned with. Henry Cavill's fine as the hero, although not really a special kind of hero. He's not sort of he's not Russell Crowe in Gladiator, and I don't like Russell Crowe very much anymore. But in Gladiator, he was the hero. He felt like a hero. Henry Cavill doesn't quite capture that, which is a shame, given that he is Superman next year, or the year after, perhaps, one of the quintessential heroes of our time, certainly in the West. The fight scenes in Immortals are fantastic, very, very inventive, very sort of gory, but at the same time beautifully done. The script is a little bit insipid, although not as bad by any stretch as the recent Clash of the Titans remake. You know, it's if you want Greek mythology churn through Hollywood, Immortals is the way to go rather than Clash of the Titans. It's just a much better film, a much more inventive film. Okay, on to the next film, which is Hugo by Martin Scorsese. Martin Scorsese's first kids' film, his first foray into 3D, a film which I personally didn't think I was going to like, and ended up enjoying a great, great deal. You don't really know what it's like based on what it's about based on the trailers, unless you've read the book, obviously. But it is basically, it's a love letter to cinema. It's set in the 20s or 30s in Paris, and it's about the rediscovery of Georges Méliès's sort of history. And it's absolutely stunning. It's a beautifully told tale. The kid that plays Hugo is very good. I forget his name. Chloe Grace Moretz is the sort of the... it's not a love interest because they're both quite young, but she's sort of the female lead. She's very, very good. Ben Kingsley's very good as an older fellow, Chloe Moretz's character's sort of godfather. It's fantastic. It's a brilliantly made film, brilliantly written, very, very well shot. I still don't think 3D is particularly, you know, the way that technology in cinema should be going. But, you know, it's not bad here. It's certainly not good, but it's not bad. But it is a great film, a very, very well shot film, a very interesting film that gives you a lot of background on the history of cinema while also providing a lovely tale of a boy discovering sort of his meaning in the world. Great, great film. Very, very good film. Next up, we've got Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows. Guy Ritchie's director for hire, second time round with Sherlock Holmes. It should be terrible. It's Guy Ritchie, who hasn't made, you know, made a lot of bad films. It's a sequel. It's a cash-in sequel, almost. I mean, it doesn't seem to be when you watch it, but it should be. It should be really bad. It's actually fantastic. Robert Downey Jr. Does just the right amount of the same and just the right amount of the different with his Sherlock Holmes. Guy Ritchie does the same with his directorial style. It's different enough that you're not bored, but it's the same enough that you know what's coming and what's been done. You know, it's very, very interesting the way it uses its cinematic devices, like with the fight scenes. The ending fight scene in Sherlock Holmes is one of the best fight scenes of the year, because, spoiler alert, The whole thing, despite Sherlock Holmes being a martial artist and Moriarty being a prize boxer, the whole thing takes place in their heads. It's phenomenally interesting. It's you know, to take the climactic fight scene and to place it inside the heads of these two intellectuals is beautifully done. It's excellently done. It's a bravo to the writers and to Guy Ritchie for doing that. It's very, very cleverly done. Jude Law's brilliant. He's the straight man to Robert Downey Jr.'s sort of comical, manic Sherlock Holmes. Noomi Rapace is good but underused. And Jared Harris as Moriarty is absolutely superb. Richard Harris's son. And in this film, he has shown that he can handle blockbuster roles with aplomb. You know, he can take a blockbuster role and turn it into a good acting piece. So hopefully we'll be seeing a lot more of him. Yeah, it's a really good film. As good as perhaps the first one. Not necessarily better. You know, there's more of the same, which isn't necessarily a bad thing in this case. It is usually, but not in this case. It doesn't excel beyond the original Sherlock Holmes. But it certainly doesn't fall far behind either. It's a very, very well worth seeing blockbuster. Okay, on to the next film, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, David Fincher's stab at the Stieg Larsson book. Daniel Craig plays Michael Blomkvist. Rooney Mara plays Lisbeth Salander. And we get a film which is, while it's cinematically better than the original Swedish adaptations of the books. You know, you get more interesting camera work, you get a more epic sense of cinematography. It doesn't do enough different to warrant being around. You know, the question I ask myself when I'm watching it is, why did they make this again? You know, it doesn't really make sense why there'd be a Hollywood remake that is so similar to the original in terms of narrative, in terms of what goes on. You know, it doesn't do enough different to warrant existing. Some of the main differences are Daniel Craig's Mikael Blomkvist is more, not more heroic, but he's more of a protagonist than Blomkvist is in the Swedish film, and Rooney Mara plays a much more fragile Lisbeth Salander, a much more vulnerable Lisbeth Salander. Noomi Rapace's Lisbeth was much more in charge, much more aggressive, much more the heroine of the story, whereas here she's kind of a woman trying to come to terms with herself. Whether that's in the book or not, I'm not sure. I haven't read it yet, but it certainly makes for one interesting potential difference. But like I said, there's not enough different in there. It makes me wonder why they made it. It's a good film. It's a good film. It's well worth seeing. If you haven't seen the Swedish version and you don't read the subtitles, then, you know, by all means, go and see the American version. It's not a bad film by any standards. And if it had been the first adaptation, I'd be saying a lot more nice things about it. But unfortunately, it's not. You know, it's following up on the heels of the Swedish adaptation. Okay, so we come to the end of my cinematic year 2011, and we end it with another sequel, this time the fourth in a series of films which, after part two, I thought could only get worse. But this turns out to be the second, if not the best, installment in the series. It's Mission Impossible: Ghost Protocol, Paramount's sort of tentpole end of year release. Directed by Brad Bird of Pixar and The Simpsons fame. This has got Tom Cruise, this time joined by Paula Patton, Simon Pegg again, Jeremy Renner, and facing Mikael Nyqvist, who was Mikael Blomkvist in the original Swedish adaptation of Girl with Dragon Tattoo. He's the villain. It turns out that Mission Impossible has got a lot of life left in it as a franchise. This was an absolutely outstanding blockbuster. Really, really well written, really well paced, beautifully directed by Brad Bird. Tom Cruise, you know, I shouldn't like him because of the Scientology, but I do. I think he's a really nice guy, and he's a very, very good film star. He's been a brilliant actor from time to time, but as a film star, I don't think there's anyone to match him in this day and age. There's a lot less of the sort of intense staring at the camera in this one, and a lot more of sort of subtle emotion, which I like. It takes J.J. Abrams' formula for Mission Impossible and sort of like brings it up to the present day. There's some phenomenal set pieces in there. The most obvious, the most famous one is the one where he's climbing up the side of the world's tallest building, which is very good. But there's also a really cool climactic fight set, among other places, in a car park sort of vending machine. And there's the opening sequence as well, which is a really, really good. Josh Holloway from Lost has a part there as an IMF agent. It's just great. It's brilliant. It's really, really good. It has a slightly, again, spoiler alert, has a slightly slushy ending, but you forgive it for that because it's you've really been with it the whole way. So Brad Bird's feature debut is a rousing success, as was J.J. Abrams' feature debut with Mission Impossible 3. It seems to be sort of a training ground for making good directors. So Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, against all the odds, the fourth film in a series based on a 1960s spy series, it turns out to be absolutely excellent. Another of the top sort of three or four blockbusters of the year. Excellently made film, and well worth seeing. So there we have it. I've got a feeling that I've missed a film out, actually. I may have skipped over The Inbetweeners, which fits in between Cowboys and Aliens and Conan the Barbarian. The Inbetweeners is a hilarious film. It's just like the series, but longer. But whereas some movies based on series end up stretching the premise too far and ending up being pants, this actually has a good story to tell in an hour and a half, and ends up being a phenomenal climax to the Inbetweeners franchise as a whole. Hopefully they'll leave it at this, because it ends on a really, really good note. It's funny, it's touching, it's gross. You can see yourself in it, you can see people you know in it. It's a universal kind of youth experience. It's absolutely superb. Again, not sure if it should be Comedy of the Year, but it's certainly a very, very good film and well worth seeing. Okay, so, looking back over the list of films of the year, I think I would have to give my film of the year to Trollhunter. I think it does enough as a comedy and as a kind of a horror action film, and as a cinematic experience that really you couldn't do on TV or on the stage or as a book. It's of its own medium. And for those reasons, and because it's expertly acted, brilliantly directed, brilliantly edited, very, very funny, very, very chilling in parts, for all those reasons, it's my favourite film of the year. And again, you know, go out and buy it and support these guys. And hopefully André Øvredal, the director, or André Øvredal, or however you pronounce his name, hopefully he will not come to Hollywood and sell out and start making terrible sequels. Hopefully he will continue to make inventive, sort of low-budget blockbusters in Norway. Only time will tell. So there we go, films of 2011, as opinionated by myself. And what does 2012 bring us? Well, it brings us a whole host of stuff. I think if I had to pick my most anticipated film of the year, it would be The Dark Knight Rises, although we also have The Hobbit, The Avengers, and a whole slew of films that haven't been shoved down our throats on the internet yet, which may well be very, very decent little dramas. Which I'm, very keen on waiting to see. Thank you for listening, if you still are. That's my year of 2011. I'll catch you next year for my year in review for 2012, assuming we're still here and the apocalypse hasn't passed. Until then, keep your ears open for Malcolm Benji's Double Bill. Happy New Year, and enjoy 2012.